take a person from point to point, like airplanes, they flew into the future. Jim wanted to fly there too. Soon he was reading books by the founding father of rocket engineering, Robert Goddard. The idea that these machines could reach beyond Earth's atmosphere lit up Jim's dreams. He read Jules Verne's novel, From the Earth to the Moon, and its sequel, Around the Moon, which tell of three adventurers who build a 900-foot space cannon that launches them in a projectile around the moon. During their journey, the men avert a deadly asteroid strike, jettison a dead dog out the window, and succumb to a mysterious force that causes them to dance and sing. They also glimpse the far side of the moon, a view unavailable from Earth. Now, 75 years after Verne had penned his science fiction masterpieces, rocket engineers were saying that an actual trip to the moon might be possible. Jim paid attention to that. By the time he began at Milwaukee's Juno High School, Jim had determined to learn all there was to know about rocketry. He discovered a report written by Goddard and published in 1919, A Method of Reaching Extreme Altitudes, and was fascinated by the vision in Goddard's mathematical calculations and his thinking about rocket fuels. The New York Times had ridiculed Goddard for suggesting that a rocket could operate in the vacuum of space or carry payloads to the moon. "He only seems to lack the knowledge ladled out daily in high schools," the newspaper wrote. Goddard responded by saying, "Every vision is a joke until the first man accomplishes it. Once realized, it becomes commonplace." To 14-year-old Jim Lovell, Goddard had more than vision. He had courage. In June 1944, the summer after his sophomore year, Jim took a job baling hay on a farm in Plymouth, Wisconsin, an hour north of Milwaukee. The pay wasn't much, about 10 cents an hour, but after work, he and the other young farmhands piled into trucks for a ride to the local lake, where they swam late into the night. Lying on his back beneath crystalline Wisconsin skies, Jim could pick out the Big Dipper, the North Star, and Cassiopeia, all of which he'd learned to use for navigation. All through the summer, celestial bodies moved across Jim's nights, calling to him from their black canvas. Working as a server of hot foods in the cafeteria during his junior year, Jim spotted Marilyn Gerlach, a pretty freshman he'd admired all year. He decided to ask her to the prom. "I don't know how to dance," she said. "I don't either," Jim replied. "We'll learn together." He went to Marilyn's house, introduced himself to her parents, and played his record albums in her living room as they practiced their dance moves. Prom night came, the dance floor shook, and Jim and Marilyn became an item. Near the end of his junior year, Jim and some friends planned to build a rocket. Gathering cardboard mailing tubes for the body and number 10 tin cans for fuel tanks was a cinch. Finding rocket fuel was another matter. Jim got a formula from his chemistry teacher, then found a company in Chicago that sold the ingredients to make the fuel. But when he arrived, something seemed amiss. The place, located in a tall building downtown, looked more like an attorney's office than a hardware store. When Jim placed his order, the receptionist arched an eyebrow. "You want sulfur, potassium nitrate, and charcoal?" "Yes, ma'am, just a few pounds." She asked for Jim's name, his full name, then summoned a man from the back. "Do you know what those chemicals make when mixed together?" the man asked.
"Yes, sir."
"Rocket fuel." "No, son. That's gunpowder." No one looked more surprised than Jim, but he told the man he was still willing to buy it. The man, however, was not willing to sell. For one, he told Jim, the company sold its chemicals by the truckful. Second, Jim was 17. third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, Jim was 17. Back in Milwaukee, Jim's teacher got a kick out of the story, then helped him and his friends find the chemicals in appropriate quantities. A few days later, a 3-foot rocket took shape, complete with wooden nose cone and fins, and a fuse made from a soda straw. Protected by a welder's mask, Jim took the creation to an open field, lit the fuse, and ran with pals for cover behind rocks. Across the way, Marilyn watched from a safe distance. On ignition, the rocket screamed into the sky, leaving a trail of crooked smoke as it climbed 80 feet before exploding and raining down blackened shards of cardboard tubing. Somewhere, Robert Goddard was smiling. Toward the end of Jim's senior year of high school in 1946, he visited a Milwaukee fairground. There, he witnessed a wonder. On display, close enough to touch, was the spent engine of a captured V-2 German rocket, the one designed by Wernher von Braun and used by the Nazis to attack European cities at the end of World War II. The rocket could travel 200 miles, carry a ton of explosives, reach an altitude of 50 miles, and attain speeds of more than 3,300 miles per hour. Electrified by the encounter, Jim wrote to the American Rocket Society, which had already existed for 20 years, and asked for advice on careers. They replied with a friendly letter telling him that universities didn't yet offer majors in rocket technology, but that he'd be well served to take college courses in thermodynamics, aerodynamics, and mathematics. To that end, the society advised, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or the California Institute of Technology, would make excellent choices. Jim had no money for college. His mother encouraged him to apply to the Naval Academy at Annapolis, from which his uncle had graduated in 1913, and Jim did that. But the best the Navy could offer was a position as a third alternate on the admissions wait list. The Navy, however, did need pilots. To get them, they were willing to pay for a student to go to college. If that student did well, the Navy would make him a military aviator. All of it would be paid for by Uncle Sam. The idea of being in command of his own aircraft thrilled Jim. He signed up for the Navy program and enrolled at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he loaded up on mechanical engineering courses and saved most of his $50 a month stipend for weekends when Marilyn came to visit. After 2 years in Madison, Lovell moved to Pensacola for flight training. Halfway through the pre-flight segment, he received orders to report to the Naval Academy. A few days later, Lovell was just another plebe at Annapolis. None of his credits from Wisconsin was eligible for transfer. He was starting from scratch. In November, Lovell invited Marilyn to the Army-Navy football game in Philadelphia. By that time, he knew he wanted to marry Marilyn, and he asked her to move out east near the Naval Academy. At the time, Marilyn was attending a teacher's college at home in Milwaukee, but she pulled up stakes and moved to Washington, D.C., where she enrolled at George Washington University and took a job at Garfinkel's department store, and started dating a medical student. Lovell could hardly blame her. He was so busy at Annapolis he hardly had a chance to call, let alone take out, his girl. And even when midshipmen got liberty for a night on the town, there were curfews and other style-cramping rules. Still, the med student didn't last long. He didn't like it when Marilyn wore Lovell's class crest on her sweater one night. Things got easier for Lovell and Marilyn in his third year when the academy allowed him more liberty. After dinner one night, he walked her to a jewelry store where they admired a selection of engagement rings. "Do you like that one?" Lovell asked. "Do you want me to have one of those?" she replied. "After 7 years, I don't want anything else," he said. Lovell tore into his final year at Annapolis. Only 50 in the class of nearly 800 would be assigned to flight school right away, and finishing strong depended in part on the quality of one's senior thesis. Most played it safe, writing on naval history or tactics. But Lovell took a leap into the theoretical. Working long into the nights and with Marilyn as his typist, he put together a study of the development of the liquid-fuel rocket engine. A paper that didn't just analyze the state of the art, but made predictions that sounded more Jules Verne than midshipman. "The big day for rockets is still coming," he wrote. "The day when science will have advanced to the stage when flight into space is reality and not a dream. That will be the day when the advantage of rocket power, simplicity, high thrust, and the ability to operate in a vacuum will be used to best advantage." Even in 1952, talking about combustion in a vacuum could seem ridiculous to the uninformed. But Lovell's vision never wavered. When the paper came back, it was marked A-. Lovell graduated at the top of the class on June 6, 1952. Later that day, he and Marilyn were married at St. Anne's Episcopal Church in Annapolis. As he'd long hoped, Lovell was chosen to attend the Navy's flight training program. He returned to Pensacola, this time as an officer, ensign, not a midshipman. A year after they arrived, Marilyn gave birth to the couple's first child, Barbara. 2 months later, in February 1954, Lovell earned his wings and was ordered to the Naval Air Station at Moffett Field in California, a few miles from Palo Alto. He was assigned to VC-3, a squadron that supplied fighter pilots trained in night operations to aircraft carriers in the Pacific. Few assignments tightened a flyer's throat like landing a jet on a darkened deck just a few hundred yards long in the dead of night. A tiny, moving runway on roiling seas. Small errors could become deadly mistakes. One moonless night in early 1955, after launching from the deck of the USS Shangri-La in an F-2H Banshee jet fighter off the coast of Japan, Lovell embarked on his first combat exercise over foreign waters. Bad weather had prevented takeoff for the last of the four flyers in Lovell's patrol. The jets that had already launched were ordered to circle the ship until they burned down their fuel, then land. Cloud cover forced the Banshees to stay just 1,500 feet above the choppy seas. Lovell banked to join his teammates in formation, but when he reached the rendezvous point, he was alone. His automatic direction finder, ADF, indicated he was heading straight for the carrier, but the ship wasn't there. The other pilots reported that they were already circling the Shangri-La. Something in Lovell's navigation had gone wrong. He checked his ADF and confirmed he was locked onto the ship's frequency, but he was not, in fact, locked onto the ship. His instrument had instead picked up a Japanese tracking station broadcasting on the same frequency. Without knowing it, he was following that signal in total darkness to the coast. Sensing that something was wrong, Lovell banked 180 degrees to look for his wingmen. All he found were empty skies. He reached for the flight plan to make sure his radio numbers were correct, but it was too dark to read the small print by the jet's ambient light. Lovell had a solution for that. He'd designed and built a small light, which he'd carried along and now plugged in. Circuits blew. Every light in the cockpit died. The airplane turned as dark as the night. Lovell had to make a choice. He could ask the carrier to turn on its lights, an embarrassment from which he might never recover, or he could continue following the signal, hoping to find the ship, or Japan, before he ran out of fuel. In the end, he chose neither. And it was all because of green. Lovell saw the color barely glowing in the water below him. He knew that algae could be made luminous when churned by the spinning propellers of a powerful ship, so he decided to follow the faint flare in the water. Several minutes later, he located his wingmen, who sat down, first one and then the other, on the deck of the Shangri-La. Next, it was Lovell's turn to land, and even though he'd found home, his cockpit was still without lights. He couldn't tell his airspeed and altitude without being able to read his instruments. But he still had a pen light, and he flipped it on, then put it in his mouth to cast its tiny beam on the instrument panel before him. Believing himself to be about 250 feet above the water, he descended toward the carrier, only to see his wingtip's red light reflect on the water no more than 20 feet below, a split second from impact. Lovell cranked back on the stick and jammed forward the throttle, sending the Banshee howling skyward and just clear of the side of the Shangri-La's deck. Heart pounding and mouth dry, Lovell now had to turn back and try again. This time he came in high, but despite frantic don't-do-it signals from the landing officer, figured he'd never get a better chance to make the flight deck, given his limited ability to read his instruments. Plummeting downward, he thudded onto the deck and skidded forward, one of his tires blowing before the carrier's last arresting wire, grabbed the jet's tail hook, and jerked the plane to a halt. Lovell's legs shook so badly he could barely climb from the cockpit. But that experience only confirmed how he felt about death. To him, the only thing guaranteed to a person was the moment. It was the only time one knew he would be there to take in the trees and the sun and the stars, to meet people, make friends, fall in love. But a person couldn't be in the moment if he worried too much about the future. That meant, in order to live, he couldn't worry about dying. The day after Lovell's wild flight, he climbed back into the cockpit and took off again. This time he put the airplane back down just where it belonged. While Lovell was training, Marilyn gave birth to their second child, James Jr. A few weeks later, Lovell watched, transfixed, as America's lead rocket designer, Wernher von Braun, appeared on a nationally televised Disney special, Man in Space. Von Braun showed viewers a prototype spacesuit like the one Americans would wear when we make the trip to the moon. And he revealed his model for a four-stage orbital rocket ship, about the coolest thing any of the 42 million people watching the program had ever seen. For the next 2 years, Lovell flew jets at sea and trained pilots while Marilyn raised the children in California. In 1957, he applied to the test pilot school at the Naval Air Test Center at Patuxent River, Maryland. The job of testing experimental aircraft built with the most advanced technology seemed a natural fit. Marilyn backed his decision and packed the Lovells to go. The training program at Pax River lasted for 6 months. At graduation, Lovell ranked first in his class. His gift from Marilyn was a new daughter, Susan, making them a family of five. Soon after, in 1958, Lovell and some other pilots at Pax River received a telex from a new government agency, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, ordering them to a meeting in Washington, D.C. They were to dress in civilian clothes and not tell anyone, including family, where they were going, or even that they were going at all. When he arrived, Lovell joined dozens of other military pilots for a briefing in a government office. Robert Gilruth, head of NASA's Space Task Group, explained that the agency was looking for astronauts for Project Mercury, a program designed to put a manned spacecraft into orbit around Earth and recover it safely. He laid out NASA's vision, talking of rockets and capsules and head-spinning speeds. "Think things over tonight," Gilruth told the men, "then report back tomorrow for more." Some participants questioned the wisdom of abandoning a Navy career to enroll in an astronaut program that hadn't yet started and might not even exist in a few years. As for Lovell, he could hardly believe his luck. Several days later, he was in New Mexico, enduring 6 days of torturous physical exams. At the end, Doctors failed him, or rather his body, for having a bit too much bilirubin, a pigment produced by the liver and found in bile. They didn't think the level dangerous, but that didn't matter. What they seemed to demand was physical perfection. "You're finished," they told Lovell, and no matter how forcefully he explained their mistake, the doctors wouldn't reconsider. "I could spell rocket before these guys ever heard the term," Lovell muttered as he walked away. Back at Pax River, Marilyn couldn't remember having seen her husband so discouraged. A short time later, Lovell received orders to report to the next phase of astronaut testing. He knew he'd been rejected and that the orders had been issued by mistake, but he seized his chance to get back in the game, even if by clerical error. He flew to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio and took the last bed in quarters. The next morning, just as the miracle seemed complete, an Air Force test pilot named Gus Grissom showed up and apologized for being late. Lovell was again heading back home with nothing to show for his dreams but a little extra pigment in his liver. For the next 3 years, Lovell continued testing aircraft and teaching students at Pax River. It was there that the nickname Shaky was bestowed upon him. Not just because no decent pilot would want such a moniker, but because the easygoing Lovell was among the least shaky men around. By 1962, Project Mercury was nearing its end, and NASA needed new astronauts. That summer, the Navy asked if Lovell would like to apply. No one seemed to remember that he'd been medically disqualified, and Lovell could find no good reason to remind them. Again, Lovell went through the testing. As a teenager, he'd seen the engine of a Nazi V-2 rocket designed by Wernher von Braun. As a young pilot, he'd watched von Braun tell the nation how America would go to the moon. After what seemed like forever, Deke Slayton called and asked if Lovell would like to ride the great engineer's newest rockets for himself. And Lovell's answer could be heard all the way to Milwaukee. He was officially one of NASA's new nine. Lovell was introduced to NASA's eight other new astronauts at the Rice Hotel in Houston. After dinner, he gave his first comment as a spaceman, telling his hometown newspaper, the Milwaukee Sentinel, that America would be first to the moon, and I want to be on the first team. In Houston, Lovell took up residence in old World War II barracks at Ellington Air Force Base, where residents lived four to a unit and had bed sheets for walls. His family soon followed, and before long, Marilyn found a house to rent in a nearby suburb. For 7-year-old Jay Lovell, that was the perfect setup. Ellington was just a few minutes away, and his dad was only too happy to take him along to the airfield to watch the training he and the other astronauts were doing in their T-38 jets. Jay loved it when his dad retracted the landing gear and kept flying just a few feet off the ground. But he stood awestruck when his father once did something radically different. On that day, Lovell pointed the jet straight up after takeoff. And as Jay watched asphalt fly and ground crew scurry, he could see that his dad was aiming right for the moon. As Lovell learned his way around his new job and his new city, Marilyn settled the family into their new home in a small Houston subdivision called Timber Cove. The sudden celebrity that came with being an astronaut startled both of them. People even recognized Marilyn around town. Lovell understood the slight resentment he and some of the other new astronauts detected from the original seven. The new guys hadn't even entered a spacecraft yet, so who were they to soak up America's adoration? Soon enough, though, the veterans warmed to the rookies. Once, when Lovell needed a ride, Alan Shepard told him to jump into his brand new 1963 Corvette, a car that had come complete with the astronaut's name engraved on a plaque. Shepard had the top down and opened the throttle on I-45 in Houston, showing Lovell what speed really meant. "Boy, how much do these things cost?" Lovell asked. "If you gotta ask, you can't afford one," Shepard replied. Lovell made a mental note. get one. In 1964, Lovell got his first assignment as one of the two-man backup crew for Gemini 4. His partner would be Frank Borman, whom he'd met during medical exams of astronaut hopefuls. Slayton had named Borman the commander, Lovell the co-pilot. To Lovell, that didn't seem quite fair. They were about the same rank, and he couldn't see why Borman was any more qualified to assume responsibility for a flight than he. But no matter who was commander, there was wonderful news in the assignment. By Slayton's scheme, Lovell and Borman would be the primary crew for Gemini 7, a 2-week Earth orbital flight, the longest mission ever planned by the space agency. In a matter of months, James Arthur Lovell Jr. would be going into space. To some, the pairing of Borman and Lovell might have seemed curious, even doomed. Borman didn't bother with space dreams, spent no energy imagining the heavens. He'd come to NASA for a single purpose, to help America defeat the Soviet Union. In meetings or in training, he could come off as brash or bullheaded if he believed you to be impeding the mission. Sometimes he'd walk out on a discussion, even over drinks after work, if he sensed bullshit in the air. That kind of directness earned Borman almost universal respect, but not everyone liked him for it. Lovell seemed Borman's opposite. He had ridden a dream of exploring the cosmos and flying rockets to new worlds from childhood all the way to NASA. And while it would please Lovell to beat the Russians, he mostly thrilled to the idea of going places forever thought unreachable and reporting back to the world about what he'd seen. Few could deny Lovell's abilities as a thinker or a pilot, but it was his warmth and friendliness that people remembered most. And yet, from the day they began working together, Borman and Lovell seemed a natural match. Each respected the other's abilities, work ethic, intellect, and piloting skills. And they made each other laugh. To many, it seemed the men had been friends since boyhood. In early June 1965, Lovell packed Marilyn and their three kids into the car and drove from Houston to the Cape to watch one of the Gemini launches in person. Asleep in bed one night at the Cocoa Beach Holiday Inn, Lovell was awakened by the sound of his wife munching saltines. "What's going on?" he asked. "I hate to tell you this," Marilyn said, "but I know, I'm pregnant." It was great news, but could not have been more awkwardly timed. Marilyn was due around the time Lovell was scheduled to fly on Gemini 7 in early December 1965. Many at NASA believed the agency would remove an astronaut from a flight if his wife was pregnant, so Lovell and Marilyn had to figure out what to do. To him, the answer was simple. Silence. He would keep training and say nothing. She would angle to be photographed from the neck up. By the time it became obvious that Marilyn was carrying, NASA would hopefully think it too late to change crews. Training consumed all the astronauts' lives. By now, some of them were struggling in their marriages, the demands of the job, and the easy availability of women on the road put a strain on their relationships. For Lovell and Borman, it was different. Neither man caroused or stayed out late, not just because it wasn't the right thing to do, but because neither had the impulse to do it. They were in love with their wives, their best friends, women who'd loved them since the days when they were nothing but dreams, their lives just a blur of military base transfers. At home, in Houston, a very round Marilyn watched on television, 8 months pregnant, as the Gemini 7 countdown neared zero. She didn't worry. She trusted in NASA and her Episcopal faith, and she trusted in Jim. When he'd left for the Cape, he hadn't given her any if-I-don't-come-home speeches or recited any I've-loved-you-forever goodbyes. Instead, he swept the garage, balanced the checkbook, and painted the cradle, in case the baby came while he was in space. As photographers snapped her photo, Marilyn watched as Gemini 7's Titan II rocket spewed billows of orange-tinted smoke, then rose on a narrow, nearly transparent column of flame into the sky. The moment Lovell had waited for since Juno High School was unfolding in thundering detail. It took 7 full seconds before he could no longer contain himself. "We're on our way, Frank!" he shouted to his crewmate. At the 2-minute mark, the spacecraft reached a speed of 3,600 miles per hour. Until now, the liquid-fuel rocket had lifted them in a kind of slow pull. But now the second stage kicked in, hurtling the ship forward with a new kind of fury. A minute later, Lovell and Borman were traveling at 7,100 miles per hour and picking up speed fast. Just under 5 minutes into the flight, Lovell caught a glimpse of something outside his window. "Look at the moon, Frank!" The rocket pushed past 7 G's and then separated from the spacecraft, sending Gemini 7 into orbit around Earth. For Lovell, the ascent was a wild and wonderful ride. For the next several days, Lovell and Borman flew their spacecraft, conducted medical experiments, and, perhaps most astonishing for two men confined to such a tiny capsule, didn't drive each other crazy. Toward the end of its 2-week flight, Gemini 7 experienced problems. The craft's fuel cells began failing, and its thrusters faltered. 2 days remained in the mission, and Borman's instinct was to terminate early. But Lovell, privately, without broadcasting a word for the public to hear, urged him to hang in and not worry, that the ship would make it. Along with Chris Kraft's reassurance, Lovell's encouragement persuaded Borman to hold on, and the flight finished near perfectly. By the time the astronauts were aboard the aircraft carrier USS Wasp, they'd set several world records for spaceflight, including longest duration. Standing on deck, the scruffy Lovell said of the 2 cramped weeks spent with Borman, "We'd like to announce our engagement." Back home, Marilyn told reporters, "Jim could come home beard and all, and I would welcome him with open arms." A month later, in January 1966, Marilyn gave birth to the couple's 4th child, Jeffrey. Less than a year later, on November 11th, 1966, Lovell was back on the launch pad as commander of Gemini 12. It was to be the final mission of Project Gemini. Strapped in beside him was Buzz Aldrin, who'd been selected as part of NASA's 3rd group of astronauts in 1963. Together, the men would spend 4 days in orbit around Earth. In some ways, the pressure on Lovell for this flight was even greater than it had been during Gemini 7. Gemini 12 had to succeed in order for NASA and the country to feel confident about launching Apollo, the program that would take America to the moon. The mission went smoothly, and after a journey of 1.6 million miles, Gemini 12 splashed down in the western Atlantic. As Lovell was hoisted from the ocean by helicopter, he held a distinction that even he couldn't have imagined 20 years earlier, when he was writing letters to rocket societies and wishing he could afford college. Jim Lovell had now spent more time in space, 18 days, than any other man in history. Chapter 8. Pushed to Superhuman Speeds. Just 2 months remained until the scheduled liftoff of Apollo 8, and even though the Apollo 7 flight had been a success, NASA still hadn't made the decision to greenlight the mission. George Lowe, Chris Kraft, and others wanted to approve it immediately. George Miller, Associate Administrator for Manned Spaceflight, still had doubts, and remained deeply concerned about the risks and dangers inherent in Apollo 8's mission. That annoyed Kraft, who believed Miller was being obstructionist because the idea to send Apollo 8 to the moon hadn't been his. Still, Kraft remembered that Miller had been willing to take risks in the past, ones that had paid off big for NASA, and Kraft couldn't disagree that the mission was risky. As October came to a close, Miller wasn't the only one concerned about the dangers of Apollo 8. By now, the media was openly discussing NASA's plan to send Borman, Lovell, and Anders to the moon. As the men in the space program consider Apollo 8, argued the Washington Post, they must not allow anyone's desire to beat the Russians or to get around the moon by the end of 1968 or to fan public interest in the future of space exploration to enter into their calculations. By this time, the astronauts were 6 weeks into their training with the command module simulators. To aid his memory, Anders had affixed small Velcro nameplates to several of the hundreds of switches, dials, and levers. Little cheats that reminded him what was what. "God damn it, Anders, it looks like a bunch of mayflies mating in here," Borman said one day at the sight of all those plates. Anders used them anyway. Before long, simulations advanced to incorporate various phases of the mission, all designed with problems built in. Some could be expected to occur on a complex mission like Apollo 8. Others seemed million-to-one shots. Many of the most challenging scenarios came during highly critical parts of the mission, such as launch, exiting lunar orbit, and re-entry, and those were practiced with particular intensity. But every part was worked through, over and over again. But no matter how much practice and simulation, no matter how ingenious the scenarios run by the sim soups, astronauts could not be trained for everything. During the highly successful Gemini program, 3 of the 10 manned flights had nearly ended in astronaut fatalities. And even if simulator training could cover the most complex and unlikely scenarios, the most basic malfunctions still could kill men in space. So Borman, Lovell, and Anders just practiced more. As the weeks passed, the Apollo 8 astronauts got to know not just the spacecraft and the mission, but also one another. Borman and Lovell already knew they flew well together. Anders was the newcomer, and a revelation to the other two men. In his 6 years at NASA, Borman had never seen a harder worker or a man of deeper integrity than Anders. It was true that Anders had his own ideas about what was important and didn't always agree with Borman on mission priorities, but he never went around Borman's authority or took a shortcut to anything. To Borman, character and competence counted more than most anything else, and Anders had plenty of both. Borman could think of no other astronaut in the entire program, long-time veterans included, he would have chosen over Anders for systems engineer. Lovell, too, thought the team lucky to have Anders, and for many of the same reasons. He admired the way Anders had handled his initial disappointment with Apollo 8's change in assignment, one that likely meant he'd never set foot on the moon. And he appreciated that Anders saw adventure and exploration in the chance to make man's first lunar journey. To both of them, going to the moon wasn't just about beating the Soviets. It was a chance to do something incredible. For his part, Anders felt welcomed by this old NASA duo. Like many, he considered Lovell a hail fellow well met, just the kind of easy hand you'd want along on a 6-day trip, whether to a fishing hole or to the moon. Borman was another matter. Anders saw much of himself in the commander, the all-business demeanor, the intensity of approach, the swiftness and certainty of opinion. Sometimes when Borman barked an order at Anders, it was as if Anders was hearing it from himself. But that didn't mean he always had to sit there and take it, even if Borman outranked him. "Look, Frank," Anders said one day, "my job is to make sure this spacecraft works, and I guarantee you that I'm going to know whether it's going to work or not. So you spend your time worrying about the mission and the rocket, and I'll worry about the spacecraft." Borman respected that. Character and competence. The crew only got better after that. Despite the synergy and good teamwork, it seemed to Lovell and Anders that Borman might be dealing with a private stress, one not shared by his crewmates. Borman had a short fuse when planners tried to add superfluous tasks to Apollo 8. He angrily rejected NASA's idea of opening the hatch in space and adding a spacewalk to the flight. More than anything, Borman seemed willing to die on small hills. A rejection of NASA's new food. A refusal to allow a TV camera on board the spacecraft. Fighting these battles, Borman argued, was necessary in order to ensure focus on the flight's basic mission. Get to the moon, orbit, get your ass home, beat the Russians, win. Add-ons and changes represented additional risk, and Borman wanted none of that. It wasn't that Borman was wrong. On almost every one of these issues, he was right. And when he wasn't, as with bringing a TV camera so that the world could witness parts of the historic mission live, he eventually heard the good sense in others' arguments and relented. But Lovell questioned whether there might be an additional dimension to Borman's near-religious aversion to risk. And he couldn't help but wonder whether it might have something to do with Susan. Borman hadn't said anything about it, but Lovell had heard mention from others that Susan was terrified by the idea of Apollo 8's new mission, and that the memories of the Apollo 1 fire still burned in her mind. As November rolled in, Kraft found himself facing a new problem. Even if Apollo 8 went perfectly, there would be no one in the Pacific to pick up the crew after splashdown, since the Navy's Pacific Fleet had already been given a reprieve for Christmas. Someone had to appeal directly to Admiral John McCain, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, to ask for special dispensation. The timing wasn't ideal. McCain's son, John McCain Jr., a Navy pilot, had been shot down over Hanoi and was being held as a prisoner of war by the North Vietnamese. But Kraft said he'd do it, and in person. A few days later, he walked into an amphitheater-style conference room in Honolulu, surrounded by 100 military captains, admirals, and 4-star generals. At 10:30 a.m. sharp, an order sounded. Attention! And McCain entered the room. Okay, young man, the 57-year-old McCain growled at the 44-year-old Kraft. What have you got to say? Kraft described Apollo 8's mission, its benefits and risks, and explained that America's greatness was about to be tested in space. Then he laid out NASA's request. This part he'd rehearsed and memorized down to the word. Admiral, I realize that the Navy has made its Christmas plans, and I'm asking you to change them. I'm here to request that the Navy support us and have ships out there before we launch and through Christmas. We need you. For several moments, there was silence in the room. Finally, McCain got up from the table and slammed down the supporting documents Kraft had provided. Best damn briefing I've ever had. Give that young man anything he wants. And with that, the Navy's aircraft carriers belonged to NASA for Christmas. In Washington, Miller continued to worry about Apollo 8. In a November 4th letter to one of NASA's top managers, he wrote, "You and I know that if failure comes, the reaction will be that anyone should have known better than to undertake such a trip at this point in time." Miller also asked the man to fill out a mission risk assessment form. To Kraft, that was a portent of things to come. Miller intended to make him and other top managers at NASA sign in blood that Apollo 8 was the right thing to do, and that they would be responsible if things went wrong. On November 5, 1968, the American people elected Richard Nixon as the country's next president. During his campaign, Nixon had promised to support the space program, as Johnson had done. "I don't want the Soviet Union or any other nation to be ahead of the United States," he told voters a few weeks before the election. "Let's emphasize the moonshot and others where we can make a direct breakthrough." NASA managers continued to debate the Apollo 8 mission into November. As they went from meeting to meeting, an unmanned Soviet spacecraft lifted off from the launch pad in Kazakhstan. Zond 6 represented the final piece of the Soviet plan to send a crew on a circumlunar mission. 2 months earlier, Zond 5 had made a successful loop around the moon, only to experience a violent re-entry that might have injured or even killed a crew. This time, Zond 6 had been designed to loop around the moon, then execute a complex guided re-entry into Earth's atmosphere, reducing G-force loads to manageable levels. If the Soviets could pull that off, the next Zond flight would go to the moon with two cosmonauts in early December and beat out Apollo 8. On November 11th, NASA Chief Thomas Paine made a final decision on Apollo 8. He phoned President Johnson, who was meeting with President-elect Nixon, and informed the men of the agency's decision. It was determined then that Paine would announce NASA's verdict on Apollo 8 to the American public at a press conference from NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Early the next day, as Zond 6 headed on a perfect course for the moon, Paine spoke to members of the media. After a careful and thorough investigation of all the systems and risks involved, he said, "We have concluded that we are now ready to fly the most advanced mission for our Apollo 8 launch in December, the orbit around the moon." The press conference lasted more than 3 hours. When it ended, reporters rushed their stories to their respective outlets. America was shooting for the moon at Christmas. 3 days after Paine's announcement, a letter arrived at the office of Bob Gilruth, director of NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. It was written by a man named Stuart Atkinson of Darien, Connecticut. It read, "Dear Sir, I wonder what sort of thinking went into your decision to send three men around the moon at Christmas time. This is by no means a sure venture, and the risk of ruining the Christmas season for millions of Americans is enormous. Christmas is a time for carefree family reunions, for as much happiness as all of us can snatch in this miserable year of 1968. We do not need a space triumph to celebrate our greatest holiday, but a failure will be the crowning blow to a people already punch drunk with the events of the year. Along with millions of Americans, I have been thrilled by the successes of the space program. But I am of the opinion that the American people would much prefer a delay of a month, if such is essential. Sincerely, Stuart Atkinson." It was around this time, about 6 weeks before scheduled liftoff, that Borman got a call from the agency's public affairs mastermind, Julian Scheer. NASA, Scheer said, had decided to have the crew of Apollo 8 make a live television broadcast on Christmas Eve. "We figure more people will be listening to your voice than that of any man in history," Scheer said. "So we want you to say something appropriate. You'll have maybe 5 or 6 minutes." "Great, Julian," Borman replied. "What are we doing?" "Do whatever's appropriate," Scheer said. Borman was surprised by the response. Scheer and NASA were leaving it up to him to decide what to say. No committees, no consensus, no vetting. Just him. By this time, the unmanned Zond 6 had already flown around the moon, passing within 1,500 miles of its surface, and was headed back to home. So confident in the mission were Soviet planners that they took the uncharacteristic step of announcing during the flight that the explicit purpose of the mission was to prepare for a manned journey to the moon. All that remained was for the spacecraft to execute its complex re-entry and touch down under parachute in Kazakhstan. Execution was near flawless. Zond 6 completed its re-entry, having endured no more than 4 to 7 Gs. The flight of Zond 6 made it clear to NASA that the Soviets were ready to send men to the moon ahead of Apollo 8, and the Soviets didn't intend to stop there. One of their experts said that the flight of Zond 6 paved the way for manned flights not just to the moon, but to Mars, Venus, and other planets. What NASA, and even the CIA, did not know was that Zond 6 had experienced two serious problems during its flight. The first, a partial depressurization of the cabin, occurred just before re-entry. The second, a failure of the parachute system, caused the spacecraft to plummet into the ground. Both incidents would have been fatal had a crew been on board. That meant the Soviets had a decision to make. Given the problems with Zond 6, should they risk sending a crew to the moon aboard Zond 7 in early December? Or should they make one more unmanned lunar flight to make certain those problems had been worked out? Those who wanted to go, including the cosmonauts, felt certain the problems on Zond 6 could be fixed and were willing to take their chances. Those who preferred to play it safe couldn't stand the thought of losing another cosmonaut in flight, as they had in a 1967 accident that still haunted the country. And many of them didn't believe the Americans crazy enough, in any case, to launch Apollo 8 in December. The Soviets had already sent two flights capable of carrying men to the moon. The Americans had sent none. NASA, they figured, would soon come to its senses and order Apollo 8 to stand down. In Houston, many worried that NASA might decide the same. Nervous personnel counted down the number of days until the next Soviet lunar launch window opened. In Kazakhstan, the Soviets moved a new Zond spacecraft to the launch pad, a ship scheduled to lift off for the moon 2 weeks before Apollo 8. Few in America knew that this spacecraft even existed. All that anyone knew in the West was that the race to the moon was being pushed to superhuman speeds that could get men killed. A recent newspaper editorial had proposed cooperation between the United States and Soviet Union, a fixing of the race so that the two nations arrived simultaneously, a way to avoid a tragedy. But neither side had come this far to compromise, and neither had Apollo 8's youngest astronaut, a 35-year-old father of five who'd been born in Hong Kong and came from fighting stock, the kind that would never settle for a tie. Chapter 9. Bill Anders. William Allison Anders first witnessed an attack from the sky by foreign invaders in 1937, when he was 4 years old. He was living with his parents along the Yangtze River in Nanking, China, when his father, a United States Navy lieutenant, sensed that Japanese forces would attack nearby Chinese boats. Arthur Anders told his wife, Muriel, to take their son and evacuate. After a 2-day trip by train to Canton, mother and son found a hotel room, and it was there that Bill watched Japanese airplanes streak overhead and bomb ships in the Pearl River just 200 yards away. The next day, Bill and his mother boarded a boat and made their escape. Bill's father stayed, manning the American gunboat USS Panay, on which he was second in command. A few days later, on December 12, 1937, Japanese aircraft attacked the Panay as it moved up the Yangtze. The United States was a neutral party in the conflict between Japan and China, and the boat, marked by American flags, was attempting to move people to safety. A bomb struck the boat's bridge, wounding and disabling the captain. That left Arthur Anders in charge. Despite America's neutral standing, he ordered the Panay to open fire on the attacking aircraft. Badly injured in sick bay, the boat's captain wanted the crew to abandon ship, but Anders wouldn't have it. "He's not in charge anymore. I am," Anders said. The Panay was not outfitted to engage attacking aircraft, but Anders directed the fight nonetheless. Soon, dive bombers appeared from the smoky skies, unleashing a second attack on the damaged American boat. Still, Anders ordered the crew to continue to defend even as the Panay slowly began to sink. Realizing that crew had been injured, Anders attempted to man one of the boat's guns himself, taking shrapnel wounds to his hands. As Anders stood on the bridge, a piece of shrapnel pierced his throat, causing heavy bleeding and making it impossible for him to speak. Using his own blood as ink, Anders scrawled out directions to the crew on a chart, and the fight continued. 80 minutes after the attack started, desperate men made their way to small escape craft. Anders was last off the boat and then lost consciousness. By the end, two Americans and an Italian journalist from the Panay had died. Dozens had been wounded, and the sinking became an international incident. Realizing that it had committed an act of war against the United States, Japan apologized. Arthur Anders received the Navy Cross, the highest honor bestowed by that branch for a peacetime action. The orders he wrote in blood are preserved in the National Museum of the U.S. Navy in Washington. The prelude to the fight would remain one of young Bill's earliest memories. Bill's parents, both Americans, had met in the Philippines during Arthur's tour of duty there. Muriel's father was the civilian in charge of the Cavite Navy Yard, which repaired American ships. Bill, the couple's only child, was born in Hong Kong. The family moved often when Bill was young, eventually returning to America in 1938. Through his childhood, Bill absorbed the Navy life, and he expected to attend the Naval Academy, as his father had. When he was 14, Bill moved with his family to Weimar, Texas. As Arthur drove Bill to school one day, father and son spotted a biplane in a field, along with a banner hanging from a fence. Airplane rides? $5. A few minutes later, Bill and the pilot were soaring over open fields. "Want to do a loop?" the man asked. Bill nodded. The pilot was low for that kind of maneuver, no higher than 2,000 feet, but he pulled up, looped over, and managed to just miss the ground as he righted the plane. Bill had a hard time concentrating in school that day. No matter how hard he tried to focus, his mind kept looping over Texas. Driving home that afternoon, Bill and his father came upon the field where Bill had flown. The plane was still there, but this time it was jammed, nose down into the ground. A terrible crash. When Arthur inquired, he was told two people had been killed during a ride. Bill looked at the seat he'd occupied in the now fractured craft and remembered how close he'd come to the ground on his loop. On airplanes, it seemed, the difference between life and death could come down to a few feet. Bill began high school in Texas, but he moved with his family to the San Diego area to begin his sophomore year. By then, Arthur had been made a Navy reservist as a result of his wartime injuries and was working at the Naval Training Station. He and Bill played catch, took car rides, and went on San Diego Mineral and Gem Society trips. As a boy, Bill had fallen in love with natural history and geology, and he resolved to own a piece of every kind of rock in the world. Sometimes the men would go high into the Sierras looking for specimens. It was on trips like that when Bill noticed that he was willing to travel almost anywhere as long as there was something new to find. Bill became president of his high school's biology club, largely on the strength of his expertise on snakes. He read books, many on science, often finishing them in one day. Instead of science fiction, Bill preferred to read about old ships from bygone eras, and about pirates and life on the high seas. Those were men who'd undertaken real adventure, who'd pushed themselves into actual, not theoretical, unknowns. As the second smallest student in his class, Bill found it hard to make time with the ladies. His love of science and snakes didn't help. Despite her son's size, Muriel encouraged Bill to play football. He suited up and was knocked flat, but he loved the feeling of getting up and realizing he had survived. After his junior year of high school, in 1950, Bill transferred to a military prep school in San Diego. Since early boyhood, He'd envisioned a life like his father's, defending his country on board a ship, fighting back. Military school would give him the best chance for admission to one of the nation's service academies. In a different time, one in which America had lesser enemies, Bill might have become a geologist. Now,